This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava, in for Peggy Wehmeyer. Let us go, we will make it. Singer Mary Boyoy echoes the hopes of many in South Sudan as the region votes on whether to split from the north. Buoyant spirits over independence, but there are challenges, including a rise in drinking.
We're tired of this world. We don't have any money. We don't have proper food. When we drink this, it will make us forget our problems.
In Port-au-Prince, the risks of reporting the news.
Here I was inside a police station where I was supposed to feel secure, and six officers assaulted me.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, but first, this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava, in for Peggy Wehmeyer. The votes are in South Sudan, where a referendum on whether the South should separate from the North has just come to an end. It appears that the vote will be a resounding yes from the mostly black Christian South, who have long felt alienated from the Arabic Muslim North. A yes vote would mean the creation of a new country, the first in Africa in nearly 20 years. Reporter Matthew Brunwasser is in Juba, the capital of southern Sudan. Thanks for joining us, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
What has been the general mood this week as voting's been going on all across southern Sudan?
South Sudanese say that this is the happiest day of their history, and I don't think that's really an exaggeration. People have never really felt like they could take their fate into their own hands and decide their own future. And when the voting in the independence referendum started on Sunday, it was really the first time that that has ever happened.
One of the things southern Sudan does have going for it is oil resources. What is the conversation about oil in the south right now?
According to the 2005 peace treaty between the north and the south, which ended the civil war, the oil proceeds have been split evenly between the north and the south. I think most people in the south do not know that they have been getting half of the oil resources for the last 5 years. So there's a popular understanding or misunderstanding that after independence, the oil wealth will kind of flow right in.
I would like to talk more about the historic voting that has happened over the past week. Over the decades, many southern Sudanese have fled that region because of the conflict. But I understand that you've talked to some who've returned to place their vote in person, even though they could have cast their votes overseas where they live now.
Yes, there are many polling places available in the United States and in other countries with large numbers of Sudanese refugees. I met a man in a neighborhood polling station who said that voting in Phoenix, Arizona, with his American wife and his American-born children, wouldn't allow him to feel the importance of the event. So he had come to Juba to vote in a neighborhood polling place, and he had a Sudanese flag wrapped around his shoulders. It was an incredibly moving experience for all South Sudanese, but for him, it was something that made him travel around the world to come back to his homeland.
We have also heard several incidents, particularly along the north-south border, where voters have been killed upon returning home. Has there been additional tension in the areas where voting is taking place, say, away from that north-south border region?
I haven't heard of any tensions related to the voting. It's been a pretty well thought out and thoughtfully implemented process. I was speaking with one U.S. official who said that even very isolated rural areas were represented in the polling and that they had delivered ballots by bicycles, motorcycles, and helicopters.
By hook or by crook, one gets those ballots to the places then.
Yeah, that's really the only way. And it's important to remember that this is a very big country. South Sudan has only 8 million people, but it's the size of France.
When is the final count of the votes expected?
The vote counting seems to be about as complicated and slow as delivering the balloting materials. The final results have to be announced 30 days after the end of voting. So that means the government is expected to announce official results on February 14th.
So it is expected, Matthew, that independence will come. What are the main challenges that you see ahead?
I think a lot of the difficulties that the South will face is that the governing is being done by former guerrilla fighters. Guerrilla fighters are good at security and creating public order, but they don't know public administration. They don't know how to build roads and schools and hospitals. And that's really what the people need. There are very few schools, there are very few hospitals outside the capital, Juba. I don't know if there's more than a couple of paved roads. The great hope that there is that when the North is no longer seen as a military threat as it is now, the government will not be so focused on security and will be able to use the oil proceeds to pay for the development of the South.
Matthew Brunwasser, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Brunwasser is a freelance reporter. He joined us from Juba, Sudan. The people of Sudan have to wait until February to hear the official results of the referendum. Many in the South hope for a brighter future if their oil-rich region separates peacefully from the North. But on the ground, there's a social problem brewing. Alcohol, which was once banned in the region because of the North's Islamic law, became easily available after the 2005 peace deal between North and South. And now, uneducated men with no jobs use alcohol to cope with their troubles. Bonnie Allen looks into the problem and how it might affect South Sudan's future.
It's 9 a.m. in Juba, South Sudan's capital, and Christina Sidia is already scooping up buckets of her most popular home-brewed alcohol. It's called Hamsa Kagiga, or in English, 5 minutes.
5 minutes, come to the gate of Sakaran.
5 minutes, she explains, because that's all it takes to get drunk. So we're standing here in a little bamboo hut where there's at least 7 or 8 big blue plastic containers that are taller than my waist, and they're filled with this murky brownish sludge that has foam on top. It's a special concoction using fermented sesame seeds and yeast that Sidia then spikes with pure alcohol. Sidia, a widow and mother of 7 children, says her customers drink all day long.
Some of the people come from home already drunk.
A few yards away, about 30 men squeeze together on low wooden benches. They dip a measuring cup into a communal tub and take turns slurping up the potent brew. They insist their visitor take a turn before joining the circle.
This one smells strong. What is this?
This whiskey of South Sudan.
It's our culture.
A small sip.
Hey. I sit down beside Ali Alado, a 32-year-old man who looks 20 years older. He has bloodshot eyes and a cigarette dangling from his fingers. Like everyone in this makeshift pub, he doesn't have a job.
We are here. There is no work. We are sitting here to pass the time with our brothers. You come here, you don't even have any money. Then if your brothers will share with you and you drink, you'll be happy and laughing together.
Men of all ages nod their heads in agreement. The drinking bucket gets passed down the line.
Welcome to our culture in southern Sudan. We're tired of this world. We don't have any money. We don't have proper food. When we drink this, it will make us forget our problems.
Another man tells me that he's trying to forget more painful memories from the civil war that killed 2 million people.
That's why I come to drink, to lose that.
That's why I come to drink, he says, to lose the memory of those people bombing us and children dying. These very public, day-long drinking binges are new in South Sudan. No longer at war, but without work, men have plenty of time to imbibe and finally the freedom to do so. Alcohol was banned in all of Sudan for more than 20 years, starting in 1983 when Islamic laws were introduced by the government based in the Arab Muslim North. During the civil war, many women still brewed alcohol in secret, but under Sharia law, they could be punished with a public lashing. Then, in 2005, the North and South signed a peace deal to end the war, and Sharia law no longer applied in the mostly black Christian South. For the first time in 2 decades, beer and other alcohol flowed into the country from neighboring Uganda and Kenya. Since then, widespread drinking has become a visible symbol of unemployment and lack of opportunity.
Yes, yes, for separation! No, no, for unity!
Yes, yes, for separation! No, no, for unity!
But there is overwhelming optimism in South Sudan these days as people rally for separation and wait for referendum results. On the street, people say that after independence, the South can develop its natural resources, including crude oil and fertile agricultural land, then build schools, hospitals, and roads, and create jobs.
After a referendum, job will come.
There's a lot of job to be done, a lot of job here, a lot of things.
There will be a lot of job.
But so far, since the end of the war, only one factory has opened in South Sudan, a beer bottling plant. In a large warehouse, a forklift driver loads crates of beer onto transport trucks. Southern Sudan Beverages Limited is the largest private employer in the region. Human Resources Director Grace Okello says the company struggled to find 300 qualified employees in a region where 8 million people live, because the majority of adults are illiterate.
Oh, it's quite a nightmare, because in the beginning, I looked at the capacity of Southerners. At that time, it was very low. We recruited people who could not even write their names. Somehow, the work was quite challenging, and they kept walking away by themselves.
Today, the factory conveyor belt rolls out 9,000 bottles of beer every hour, and it still can't meet the demand. Okello admits that the beer business contributes to social problems like alcoholism, street fights, and drunk driving. But more importantly, she believes it's creating jobs and setting an example for more foreign investment.
Some of the good things that the investors will find here is there's a lot of space. Wherever you want to put the factory, there is space. There is enough resource. But the biggest challenge would be to find the right people to do the job. Because most of the educated people, most of the people who have skills, are still outside of Southern Sudan.
Okello, who studied business in Uganda, says that South Sudan needs to attract back Sudanese who fled the war and got an education in other countries. But at night, on the dark streets, I find drunk men who never had that chance.
Now I'm even working at a bush, even cutting a charcoal and cutting some wood to feed my children.
That's Peter Tombe. The middle-aged man says that he hopes for development in a new South Sudan, but he's also afraid he'll be left behind.
To get a job, it is a problem. Because if you run after the jobs, you never get.
So like his friends, he'd rather drink than deal with that disappointment. For the World Vision Report, I'm Bonnie Allen in Juba, South Sudan.
There are challenges ahead in South Sudan, but for the moment, the focus is on gaining independence. One voice of optimism is that of Mary Boyoy, a singer from South Sudan. Her rallying cry is heard in this song and its lyrics, "Let us go, we will make it." Coming up on the World Vision Report, the power of radio in Haiti's largest slum. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava. It was a year ago that the earthquake struck Haiti. Just a few months ago, the island was almost hit by a hurricane, and right now, Haitians are dealing with a deadly cholera epidemic. One lifeline through all of these crises has been radio. Haitians have been able to get information from the airwaves that has been difficult to come by on the ground. Reporter Scott Gurian visited a community radio station in Haiti's largest slum and sent us this report.
Water laps gently against the shore of the Bay of Port-au-Prince, while kids go skinny dipping and majestic mountains reach up to the clouds off in the distance. At first glance, it looks kind of idyllic, but for Joachim Jarrell and the 300,000 people who live here, Cité Soleil is no paradise. In fact, it's a sprawling slum that has a reputation for being one of the roughest parts of Port-au-Prince. So A few years ago, Jarrell and some of his friends realized they had to do something.
Armed groups from different parts of the neighborhood were fighting against each other. Young men carried guns, and young women got pregnant at very early ages. We decided to address these issues by starting a radio station so we could tell the youth about alternatives to violence and make a difference in their lives.
They decided to call the station Radio Boukman after Dudi Boukman, a voodoo priest who led a slave revolt that gained Haiti its independence. Nearly 5 years later, Radio Boukman has become a fixture in the community. Bonjour, bonsoir, journal, mi-temps-journée, rentrez la caillou. Much of the station's programming, like this noontime newscast, focuses on providing residents of Cité Soleil with the kind of life and death information they can't get anywhere else. With little information, cholera, and widespread devastation, people grow angry. But Jarrell says the reporting on Radio Boukman has helped diffuse some of the tension.
Through the radio, we've had an opportunity to bring together the leaders of the different groups to work out their differences on the air. Even if they don't agree on things, they can still sit down and talk, because they're all human beings, and most problems can be solved by talking things out.
After the earthquake, Radio Boukman's broadcasts helped relief groups like Doctors Without Borders by providing first-hand reports about what sections of the city needed the most aid. And during hurricane season, the station aired a daily program telling residents how to prepare for approaching storms.
Most of the other media tend to ignore Cité Soleil.
Orpha Dessous is one of Radio Boukman's six reporters.
Anytime journalists give any attention to the people who live here, they get really excited because it's not very common.
Dessous is 30 years old. She only started at the station less than 2 years ago. Today, she sits behind a glass window in a small wood-paneled recording booth. She's working with an editor to assemble a radio piece about the start of the new school year. Other stories she's worked on have taken her to the maternity ward of a local hospital and into the lives of dock workers at the nearby port. Dessous covers a violent, gang-ridden community. She matter-of-factly tells what happened the week before when she tried to get some information from the local police precinct. The police told her to leave, saying, "We don't answer questions from little journalists." Then they hit her on her back, threatened to smash her head and kill her, and tore off her press pass.
I've interviewed a lot of bandits and thugs in this neighborhood, and they always joke around and give me the best welcome. But here I was inside a police station where I was supposed to feel secure, and six officers assaulted me.
Radio Boukman says this is the third time police have attacked one of their reporters, and they've filed an official complaint and a lawsuit to prevent it from happening again. Dessous says listeners seem to appreciate the lengths to which she and her colleagues go to cover the news.
The first question people ask you when you try to interview them in the street is, "Which station are you from?" And when you say you're from Radio Boukman, they always say, "Oh, this is our radio. This is the radio of the people. So we're willing to talk and share our story with you."
For the World Vision Report, I'm Scott Gurian.
From Haiti, we crossed the Caribbean to Cuba. It took a while for hip-hop to catch on in Cuba, but that has changed recently. A group called the Orishas has found a way to combine rap with traditional Cuban rhythms. Our world music guide, Ish Mufundikwa, spoke with Peggy Waymeyer about the band.
Ish, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Peggy. It's always fun being on the show.
And today we're going to talk about a band called the Orishas. They're Cuban, but they're not really living in Cuba. Where are they?
They're living in Europe. I think they started performing their music in Cuba, and then a couple of them moved to Paris as exchange students, and then they got together with other Cubans in exile and formed the Orishas.
And they've actually got a song about the difficulties of living as expatriates.
It's a song called 537 Cuba, and they pay tribute to their home country and also to Compay Segundo, one of the finest Cuban pianists who was also a member of the Buena Vista Social Club. And one of the verses talks about missing his homeland and his traditions and his friends that he grew up with, maybe never to see them again.
That sounds like they're mixing a little Latin flavor with rap.
Yes, exactly. That's what they're doing. Actually, that chorus is from Chan Chan, which was on the album, the Buena Vista Social Club, that huge album of theirs of a few years ago.
Hmm.
So they are mixing both Latin sounds and hip-hop.
Now, how popular is this music in Europe? It's interesting that they live in Paris and they're playing this Cuban Latin rap music. How does the audience in Europe respond to them?
It is very popular, especially in France and Spain, obviously because they live there, and I guess they get to do a lot of live gigs. And of course, Spain, I'm sure they understand the language as well. So, yeah, it is pretty big.
I'm just wondering how much of their sound is traditionally Cuban and what else they add to it.
Well, like rap everywhere, I think it's a fusion of different sounds. And initially, I think they just started with beats like they do in the United States, straight ahead hip-hop. But when they moved to Europe, that's when they started mixing traditional Cuban sounds. And that did cause quite a bit of a controversy where some people were saying, well, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. You should leave that traditional stuff alone. But, you know, I think what they're trying to do is to appeal to the audience back home, the audience in Europe, and also trying to emphasize where they're coming from.
Is there a song we can hear where we'd get a feel for the traditional Cuban flavor of their music?
Yeah, I think maybe we could listen to Silencio.
El hermano de la calle es el problema social. Ahora mismo puede arrastrar. Estoy parado frente a la tropa de nuevo y no juego. Hay que acabar con esto antes de que corra el fuego.
Dolorosa. Pero triste realidad, mundo donde se ha perdido claridad.
Ish, the Orishas also write lyrics about social issues, racism being one of them. How much is racism talked about openly in Cuba?
What I know is that, you know, Cuba tries to present this picture of being a colorless society where black, white, and everybody else lives happily together. But the Orishas, in their music, they started addressing the social issues of being black in Cuba. And I think the strongest statement they started off with is their name.
Mm-hmm.
Orishas is actually a set of gods worshipped by African-based religions. They picked up on that name to emphasize their connections with Africa.
And I guess the blacks in Cuba come from the African slaves who were introduced into Cuba from Spain in the 16th century?
Yeah, they were actually brought from the African mainland, from West Africa mostly, to Cuba to work in the sugarcane field.
And so they sing about this racism as a social justice issue, but they also write about other social issues. What other issues are they tackling in their music?
They sing about the difficult times that immigrants go through. I mean, they talk about going to Europe and hoping that things are going to be all easy once they get there. But they talk about how despised immigrants are in Europe, coming from wherever they come from. And these are some of the issues that they talk about.
Is there a song about that that we should hear?
Yeah, it's a song called Emigrante. I think it's not a very happy song. I think it's a very angry song about the hard times that immigrants go through once they get to Europe.
Ciudades, pueblos, lugares. Me has colonizado y ahora discriminas tú mi raza.
lyrics are somewhat different from a lot of rap music, especially music we hear in this country, which can often be sexist or violent.
I think it wouldn't be correct to say that all hip-hop or rap coming out of America is sexist. I think there's also a lot of rap coming out of America that addresses issues. But I think the Orishas, they're really talking about issues that they have to deal with coming from Cuba. And also, like, the last song that we heard about being immigrants in Europe.
Now, there's another song I'd like to listen to because it really represents the music and dance spirit of Cuba. Can you tell us anything about this song before we play it, Ish?
Represent. Yeah, sure. Represent is, this is, as they would say on the street, they're bigging up Cuba.
What does that mean?
They're praising their home country, and it's about representing the spirit of Cuba with music and dance.
Ish Mufundikwa is our world music guide. He spoke to us from his home in Harare, Zimbabwe. Whether you're budding hip-hop stars or ordinary people leaving home in search of a better life, immigration can be difficult. For Central American migrants heading to the United States, the challenges start from the get-go. The journey north is fraught with danger. Thousands are assaulted, kidnapped, or injured every year. And that is before they've reached the border between Mexico and the U.S. In our next story, the third in our series on immigration, reporter Grant Fuller takes us to a shelter near the Guatemala-Mexico border that's become a hub for migrants needing help.
Ruben Perez needs a new leg. He's leaning on a crutch in the doctor's office as he carefully slips out of his old prosthetic. Perez shows the orthopedist where his plastic mold is cracked. The doctor explains that he'll have to measure him for a new one. After the appointment, Perez sits in the back seat of a pickup truck and tells me his story. A little over a year ago, he was making his way north to the U.S. But just before he got there, he fell and lost both legs trying to hop a train. He eventually made it back to Tapachula, near the border with his native Guatemala, where he knew help was waiting at a shelter called Jesus el Buen Pastor, Jesus the Good Shepherd. Its primary mission is to care for migrants injured on their journey north. For now, Perez lives at the shelter. It paid for his original prosthetic legs and will pay to replace his damaged one.
Thanks to the shelter, I've got a second chance. They already helped me once, and now I've asked them again, and they say no problem. So I never lose faith that things will work out.
The shelter is a walled concrete compound on the outskirts of town. There are currently about a dozen migrants staying here, some injured and some not. A handful of them rest in shared rooms with hospital beds, while others make crafts in the sparse TV room or sit by the roadside watching the occasional truck pass by. Olga Sanchez is the founder of Jesus el Buen Pastor Shelter.
The way we offer them support is, first of all, to integrate them into our family so that they feel at home and they no longer feel like they're in danger. Next, we help them recover from bodily wounds they might have on their legs, arms, or whatever. Medicine, clothes, shoes, return bus tickets. The shelter provides all of that.
Sanchez has suffered from serious health issues herself since she was a child. Once, when she was hospitalized, she met two Salvadoran migrants whose legs had been amputated by a train. The chance encounter led to what is now her life's work.
It made me so sad to see them so alone, and that feeling started to consume me little by little. So I began to dedicate myself to that more and more, and here I am now. I've built a home for them.
A volunteer stands outside a school, trying to sell a plate full of donuts. The shelter is in deep debt and has no regular source of funding, but Sanchez has kept it going by selling homemade donuts and crafts made by the migrants. Every migrant here has great respect for Sanchez. They call her a lifesaver, and she feels deeply connected to all of them.
And the names of all these people stay with me.
The train rides north have always been dangerous. You could fall off the roof where the migrants sit and get chewed up by the wheels like Ruben Perez. You could get caught by immigration police or simply freeze on top of the train. But these days, gang violence is by far the biggest worry. The train no longer leaves from Tapachula, where the shelter is, so migrants have to walk more than 100 miles along the tracks to catch it. And that stretch is where many of them run into trouble. Jose Luis Morales slices limes and squeezes them into a cup. He's in a wheelchair, the recent victim of an attack in which his foot was broken. Helping out in the shelter's community kitchen keeps his mind off his troubles.
I'm trying not to think about my family. If I start to think only about them, I could make myself even sicker. It hurts me to be thinking about that all the time.
Until recently, Morales lived in Miami with two young sons and his mother. He decided to go back to Guatemala and bring his little sister to the U.S. But after crossing the border into Mexico, they didn't make it very far. Two men armed with machetes robbed them of $2,000 as they hiked along the tracks. They threatened to rape his sister, and when Morales fought back, they crushed his foot with a rock and ran away.
And I started to scream, and I kept screaming for about 2 hours, and nothing. Then a man pulled up in his car and asked me what happened. I told him they assaulted me, and he told me they always attack Central Americans in that place.
That good Samaritan took him to the Tapachula Hospital, which often treats migrants and then refers them to the Buen Pastor shelter for longer-term care.
I don't worry about anything because Miss Olga is supporting us here. When she can, she even comes to take care of us herself.
No matter how much they feel at home, the shelter is usually a brief pit stop for migrants. Jose Luis Morales says as soon as his foot heals, he'll try again to get back to his sons in Miami. But not everyone here is so keen on trying their luck one more time. In the room next door, Wilfred Gonzalez lies flat on his back with a bandage around his arm and screws coming out of it. He was recently shot by criminals near the train tracks in northern Chiapas.
I'm better off just staying in Honduras. I may not make much money, but I live in peace. I don't want to lose my life or my arm. I take back that dream I had. All I want is to be together with my family and have the hope of being healthy again.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Tapachula, Mexico.
Grant sent us photos to go with this story. You can see them at worldvisionreport.org. In Lebanon, a town called the Village of Heaven has become a symbol of peace and unity. That story in a moment on the World Vision Report. Algo de mí se ha perdido en... This is the World Vision Report. I'm Melinda Pencava. The Lebanese government is in disarray after 11 members resigned a few days ago. There's concern that this power vacuum may lead to a new conflict in the region. Few want to see Lebanon return to the state of war that existed in the 70s and 80s. That civil war ground on for 15 years. 150,000 people died. Mansour Labaki remembers it well. The Maronite priest evacuated a group of orphans to France. Now, as adults, some of them are helping the priest create a safe haven for children just outside Beirut. Will Everett reports from Lebanon.
The sun sets over the Mediterranean as we climb a hill overlooking the ancient city of Byblos, an hour's drive north of Beirut.
This is the first house built here. This is the starting house, if you want.
Rami, the young man driving, points to a stone house that looks like it might have been constructed centuries ago. If there's pride in his voice, it's because he helped build it the year before.
And here is the theater.
A straight gravel road flanked by young olive trees leads to an amphitheater large enough to seat several thousand. A small stone church stands nearby, but the roads out of the amphitheater lead to empty lots marked with flagged sticks for future construction.
It will be a traditional village, yani small little houses, Lebanese traditional houses built by stones.
That's Rami's friend Ellie. The two young men have known each other since childhood. They were among 40 orphans airlifted out of Beirut in 1990 during the bloody civil war. They've spent the last year on and off overseeing construction of this village. It's called Kfar Sama, the Village of Heaven, and it's being built by the priest who rescued them 2 decades ago.
The idea of Kfar Sama is their idea.
That's 68-year-old Father Mansour Labaki.
One day we were discussing, and they said, we want to water others as we were watered by you, like flowers. We need a space in order to bring the street children for vacations, for scouts, etc. So I started first summer.
Father Labaki says this pastoral retreat will be used by children, especially orphans, of all religious persuasions. By having kids of different religious backgrounds get to know each other, Labaki hopes they'll take away friendships that will inspire religious tolerance later in life. And so, in a small way, he might help to prevent another religious conflict like the one of 20 years ago. Father Labaki wasn't surprised when a number of his orphans got on board to help with the construction of the village. They've been part of Labaki's extended family ever since the day in 1990 when he took them to spend a year away from the fighting in Beirut.
I wanted to heal the children. They were traumatized. They were sick. They needed surgeries. They needed to go to school. They needed to continue to study. It's like some Lebanese were studying in France because they had money. And this orphan would have studied in France if they had money. Give them a chance.
And that's what Father Labaki did, taking 40 orphans to study in France. Years before that, Labaki was a priest on the front lines of the fighting. In 1976, his parish of Damour was massacred by Palestinian extremists.
The last day after a siege that lasted 12 days, the last day I gathered the survivors, some of the survivors, in the church, and I asked them to forgive those who were coming to kill them. Because I believe that forgiveness is the way for peace.
As he recalls the story, he sits down at an out-of-tune piano in his parish office. He still remembers the song he had his fearful congregation sing while they were awaiting their death.
The one we sung when we were prepared to die. Lord, I seek you alone. Lord, my love, I confess.
They barely survived by slipping out to the seaside and evacuating on boats. Rami, one of Labaki's orphans, has his own memories of the war. When he was six, a group of militants came into his classroom and led his teacher away at gunpoint, executing him in the school courtyard. He says building the children's retreat is difficult work, but he doesn't want any child to ever see the things he's seen.
Father Labaki wanted to give me the chance of giving, like he did. When I was small, he gave me all I need, if you want. And now he give me the same chance to help others. When we have something, it's very good. And when we give something, it's better, I think.
You alone are my goal.
And according to Father Labaki, giving back is what Kfar Sama is all about. It'll be years before all those surveyor stakes are replaced by buildings. He's funding it one building at a time, through mostly private donations. He doesn't know if he'll live to see it finished, but he knows the project will be in good hands when he's gone. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Beirut, Lebanon.
Lord, I seek you alone. Lord, my love, I confess.
People who live through conflict and war often end up with psychological problems. Dr. James Gordon is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist who has seen this up close. He's worked in parts of the world torn by war and trauma, Kosovo to post-Katrina New Orleans. He's also counseled soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. James Gordon's approach mixes traditional psychotherapy with contemporary self-help techniques. In Gaza, more than 10,000 people have taken part in these stress relief programs. In a conversation with Peggy Waymire, Dr. Gordon says the program helps Palestinians cope with life in what they call their open-air prison.
That's really what it's like. There are 1.5 million people in Gaza. There's about 70 to 80% unemployment. And nothing comes in or out of Gaza without the approval of the Israeli government that controls all entrances and egresses. So you have a situation that is an incredible pressure cooker, and you have 1.5 million people jammed together in a really tiny geographical area, and wondering all the time what's going to happen next. Is there going to be an attack from the Israelis? Is there going to be violence within Gaza? Are people inside Gaza going to provoke an attack? So it's an incredible pressure cooker of a situation, and everybody is anxious much of the time.
I'm wondering if you could describe for us the kind of therapy you've been doing with the people in Gaza.
Sure. What we do with people in Gaza, and I'm not the one who's doing it, what my international team and I do is we train local people, physicians, psychologists, nurses, social workers, teachers, religious leaders, and others in techniques of self-awareness and self-care. And then we teach them how to lead small groups in which they teach these techniques. There's an emphasis on meditation and education as being primary healing elements. By meditation, I mean concentrative meditation like soft belly, slow, deep breathing, focusing on the breath. We use mindfulness or awareness meditation, becoming aware of your thoughts, feelings, and sensations as they arise. And we use expressive meditation, shaking and dancing, or fast, deep breathing, or jumping up and down and shouting, which is the oldest form of meditation. Self-expression in words, both spoken word and written exercises, drawings, different kinds of drawings. And we also work with genograms, with family trees, to help people find strength in their family.
And they do this in the form of group sessions, am I right? So people start and join a 10-week session led by one of these trained counselors?
Exactly. We prefer to work in groups. It's great to be part of a group. It gives you a place to share what you're learning with others, to get encouraged by others, to share your frustration when you come up against difficult times. One of the problems in a place like Gaza, which in is a closed society in many ways, is people can't express themselves freely. They don't want to go against the social norm. They don't want to do anything that might offend whoever is in power. But in these small groups, they can actually say what's going on, what's happening, what they're feeling, what they're thinking, what they're worried about, what they're angry about. And they can also easily learn the techniques that we teach them.
I want to talk a little about the techniques. You use the terms self-awareness and self-care, which could be pretty broad. Can you give us a couple examples of what, if I'm joining one of these groups, a 10-week session, what I might learn about self-care?
Sure. That's a great question. The first thing about these groups is we advertise these groups as these are skills groups. We're going to teach you things that you might want to learn to take better care of yourself. So people come not because they have a disease, not because they're sick, but because they want to help themselves. So right from the beginning, we frame it that way. The initial technique that we teach is called soft belly, and it's very simple. It simply involves breathing deeply in through your nose and out through your mouth and allowing your belly to be soft. And you'll notice as the muscles relax in your belly, that all the muscles in your body relax as well. So people do this. We have a wonderful video where you see a 5-year-old kid who was one of the most disruptive kids in his kindergarten. So, and in Gaza, that means he was pretty disruptive. He's doing this technique and he says how peaceful it makes him. It's like a balloon. And he's taught it to all his brothers and sisters. We teach guided imagery, using a mental image after you get relaxed to create a safe and comfortable place, which is really important everywhere, but particularly in a place like Gaza, where in fact no place is safe and not so many are even comfortable.
Well, so Dr. Gordon, after you've done this, and it is very relaxing, I'm relaxing myself thinking about it, but what do you add to that?
Each group, we teach a different technique. So when we're doing imagery, after we encourage people to be in a safe place, we ask them to allow an inner guide or a wise guide to appear in their imagination. This is, depending on what your perspective is, it's a part of your unconscious, it's part of your imagination. Some people think it might actually be a spirit. But we say to people, you can ask this wise guide questions you have that are currently baffling you. One boy who was in one of our groups, 16-year-old boy who saw his best friend killed by Israeli soldiers. After that happened, he became incredibly agitated in school. He was having flashbacks, watching his friend die. He couldn't sleep at night, and he began to go out every day and throw stones at the Israeli tanks because he wanted them to kill him. He wasn't a bomber, but he was, in a sense, committing suicide. When he consulted his wise guide, the guide was first his grandfather, who told him just to relax, everything would be okay. Then he consulted the Quran. The Quran came to him in his imagination as the wise guide. It quoted a shura, a verse about peace. And then, to his great surprise, his friend who died appeared in his imagination. And his friend said to him, Ahmed, stop throwing stones at Israeli tanks. You will do them no harm. You will do me no good. And getting yourself killed is not the honorable path for you. What I want you to do is live to be an old man, have many children, and when your time comes, you will join me in paradise. He stopped from that day on. He never threw a stone at an Israeli tank.
Whoa, this sounds so simple.
It is.
And how successful is it? Have you been able to measure whether or not these people find relief from their anxiety and whether it sticks?
In a study of 500 children in Gaza, children from the age of 3 to 18, of those children who had diagnosable post-traumatic stress disorder, it was 129 children, we saw an 80% improvement in symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, which include agitation, nightmares and flashbacks about trauma, emotional withdrawal, just like this boy I described. And at 7 months follow-up, most of those gains were retained. We also saw significant improvements in depression and a very significant improvement on a scale of hopelessness, which is really critical in a place like this. And that was completely maintained at 7 months follow-up with no intervening therapy at all.
And I understand you've used this same program in Israel, particularly when rockets were being shot from Gaza. I find it interesting that you've worked on both sides of this conflict. And I'm wondering, what have you noticed in terms of similarities and differences between the people on both sides?
Yes, we have a very parallel program in Israel. We've trained 240 people in Gaza. We've actually trained over 400 in Israel. And we've used this model in Sderot during as well as after Hamas was firing rockets from Gaza. And our work is, we're not there to take sides. We're there to offer an opportunity for healing to all those who want it. You know, the situation in Israel is certainly not as dire as it is in Gaza. But when the conflict is happening, there is a very significant level of anxiety and agitation in the Israeli population. You see the same kinds of behaviors in kids, difficulty concentrating, nightmares, bedwetting, the same kinds of anxiety in some of the communities that are under fire.
Have you taken this model to other countries where there have been traumatic conflicts?
Yes, we began in Bosnia, and really our model, the kind of flowering of our model was in Kosovo, where we trained 600 health and mental health professionals and educators, and our work is now completely integrated into the health system in Kosovo.
That's Dr. James Gordon, clinical professor at Georgetown University and director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine in Washington, D.C. He's in Haiti right now, where his team is helping people deal with the aftermath of last year's earthquake.
Thank you. نهزت البلاد هاني اليوم نحكي معاك باسمي واسم الشعب الكل اللي عايش في الاحلام 2011.
What you're hearing now is a song by a Tunisian rapper who calls himself The General. He was imprisoned this week in a government crackdown in that North African country. His crime? Posting a protest song online, a song critical of government policies. The title of the song is blunt, Mr. President, your people are dying. It takes aim at Tunisia's unemployment and deepening poverty. The rapper's imprisonment comes as increasing numbers of Tunisians have taken to the streets to protest against joblessness, high food prices, and restrictions on their freedom. And for this week, that's the World Vision Report. Thanks for listening. You can find us on the web at worldvisionreport.org. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is our assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. Doug Boyles, our sound engineer. And Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Sitting in for Peggy Wehmeyer, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization. I'm